This Week in Retronauts, the jokes just write themselves. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this is an impromptu, well, I say impromptu, but not really, because I spent the morning writing notes, but it is a guerrilla Retronauts episode at PAX East, and I'm here with my future panelists. It sounds so formal. Introduce yourselves, guys.
I'm Benj Edwards.
And who are you?
I am a freelance journalist. Well, I was a freelancer. I just got hired at How To Geek as a staff writer, but I'm a game historian, and I run VintageComputing.com.
And I am Bob, the founder of RetroRGB, which is a website that teaches people how to use old consoles on new equipment, and there's news and guides and all that fun stuff.
And I'm Jeremy Parrish. You've probably heard me before on the show, so I don't need to introduce myself again because I'd be boring. But what won't be boring is our discussion this week, which is trackball games. And I'm sure our resident comedian is going to make a lot of jokes about balls. We've been through this before, so you can look forward to that. But in the meantime, we're also going to have a very meaningful discourse about the history behind trackball games, because it's something we haven't really talked about. And the trackball genre, if you can call it that, kind of touches on some interesting and historically important games. Like, there's nothing really unifying any of these games, honestly, aside from the fact that they all use a trackball as an interface. But why don't we begin by actually defining what the heck a trackball actually is?
All right, so a trackball is an interface that involves a ball mm-hmm. and a track.
Very good.
I think that...
What kind of track are we talking about
here? I think it was tracking missiles originally, honestly, like missile tracks and missile defense type things. That's why they're invented in the 40s or 50s or something.
I didn't realize the technology went back that far.
Yeah. There was one... I don't know the specifics about it, but I know they were invented as an interface for early analog computers to... for sort of missile defense purposes where you could... Or maybe airline tracking purposes where you could move a cursor on a screen easily with the ball.
Hmm.
So I think you were tracking the trajectory of an airplane or a missile or something. I think that's where the track comes from. But I could be wrong.
No, that's great. I admit that I did not do any research into the origins of the trackball because I wanted to be surprised by the knowledge that you brought to the show.
Oh, you're lucky. So, I actually knew that.
Yes, it was really... It was a good... Yeah. Very fortunate. But no, I always assumed they were called trackballs because there is a... like a sensor, you know, an optical sensor or a physical sensor inside the mechanism that tracks the motion of the ball, but I guess that's not the case.
Yeah, it could... I mean, it could be both, like, one of those things where they, you know, it became...
Don't second guess yourself. Just say yes, well, confidently, even if it's wrong.
Even if it's wrong.
That's the podcasting way.
Well, there's a lot of things where, like, a term will become... back-defined, whatever the term, you know, like redefined to mean something else later.
Retconned.
So, yeah, trackballs were retconned, probably. But, yeah, I mean, you are tracking the ball as it moves, usually with the two axes, you know, like an X and a Y, like a wheel on the X and a wheel on the Y, and as you move the ball, it keeps track of... You combine those coordinates to make a position in two-dimensional space.
Right. It basically uses the motion of a ball to define the location of a cursor or something on screen. Yeah. And what happens when you turn a trackball upside down? What do you get?
You get Douglas Engelbart's amazing invention, the mouse.
Say it louder
the
for
mouse.
Those in the back row.
Old school computer mouse.
Yes.
People listening might not remember that a mouse used to have essentially a trackball.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yep.
I don't even use mice these days. I'm a laptop trackpad user.
Oh, I can't.
So
I
can't go back to mice at this point. But yeah, like back in the olden days, you'd have to clean the mouse ball because it would get filthy with all the caked on gunk from your hand on the trackpad and or the mouse pad, and you'd have to take
rollers.
cotton swabs, and cotton squibs.
The rollers would get gunked up. Mm-hmm. One of the coolest accessories Nintendo ever made was the official mouse Nintendo mouse cleaner device. Like
I didn't realize they did that.
The Super NES mouse came with a little cleaner, a little white kind of pick-like thing to clean the tracking.
I did not know that.
Wheels inside.
It's like a dental pick, but for a mouse.
Yeah, a Nintendo pick.
I'll have to look one of those up. I've got the Super Famicom mouse that comes with Mario and Wario.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's like, wow, that didn't come to the U.S. That's neat.
Yeah.
But I've never really used it that much, and certainly not enough for it to get gunky.
You never played Mario Paint?
I've played it, but I don't have it.
You don't have it.
Okay. I don't have the Mario Paint set.
Yeah, I got Mario Paint back when it was kind of new, and so I loved that mouse. I thought it was so cool.
In a sense, Mario Paint is a kind of trackball game, but it's an upside-down trackball game. And so, therefore, it does not count for the purposes of this discussion. We are looking at arcade games, basically, that have trackballs mounted into the arcade console. And that's something that you actually still find these days, because one of the biggest and most enduring game series in the world, Golden Tee Golf, mm-hmm. is based around trackball and really gets into the sort of accessibility and physicality that makes trackball so appealing. And they, whoever the developer is, I can't remember their name, they really just leaned into that and they found kind of a gold mine, a Golden Tee gold mine, if it were, as it were.
So, yeah, that's a great game. I guess we'll get to that as we walk through the history.
We will. But, Bobby, you made a mention of some consoles and computers that have had trackballs as accessories.
Yeah, so I didn't actually realize this back when it was released, but the Sega Master System had a sports pad, which was essentially a trackball with the two Sega Master System buttons. That was released in 1987, and it only worked with three games, hockey, football, and soccer. To be honest, I don't think I've ever actually played those games, because they generally weren't very good.
Right.
But that controller can be switched out of trackball mode, or at least the U.S. version of the controller, not the Japanese. And you can use that with other stuff. So I did recently try that with Marble Madness on the Genesis.
Ooh.
And thought it worked pretty cool. I enjoyed it.
Really? That's actually very cool.
Yeah, because so it simulates a directional pad then in a different mode?
Like, correct.
Okay.
So at that point, it's essentially like pressing left, right, or down a whole bunch of times, and you just have to keep spinning to do it. But it works for a game like Marble Madness that was originally released with a trackball.
Yeah, you don't historically see a lot of trackball controllers for consoles, and not a lot of games specifically for consoles designed around trackballs. And the Master System's very limited library of trackball games kind of gets to what the majority of arcade trackball games were about. Like, you will overwhelmingly see sports games based around trackball controls.
Mm-hmm. I know the Famicom, somebody made a trackball controller for it. I don't know if it's just simulated the pad or if it actually had analog proportional control, as they call it, but there's none for the NES in America that I know of. But you know, I have one for the Atari 800 and one for the there's one for the ColecoVision and one for the Atari 5200 that's as large as the console. It's
of course,
a giant thing.
Why not?
Like, and
you can tell the future in it.
Yeah, your future's bad. This is a
you
bad
bought
system.
A ColecoVision, sorry.
That's
I was going to say that, you know, I think probably the most successful home computer or like home version of a trackball for gaming purposes came from Atari. And it makes sense because they were really sort of the dominant force in trackball gaming in the arcades.
Yeah.
So it kind of fits. They didn't make one for the 2600, but they did make one for their 8-bit computers, the 800 and 400. And I think you can use that on the 7800, based on some stuff I read.
Yeah.
Although there aren't really that many games, if any, that use it.
Yeah, there's. It's one of those things that has different modes. So there is a mode on it where you can use it like a directional pad. And I think even on the 800, there's only one or two games that actually support the proportional control. One is Centipede, a version of Centipede, and one is Missile Command, I think. So,
which makes sense, because those were their two biggest games.
Yeah, it's disappointing, though, that more games don't actually support the actual proportionality of it.
But, you know, we just ran the Weird Controllers episode for Retronauts patrons. If you subscribe for $5 a month or more, you can listen to that. But we talked about the Arkanoid Vaus controller, you know, that was a really cool controller that was used for exactly one game.
Yeah.
Two in Japan. You can also play Arkanoid 2, which didn't come to the U.S. And that's it.
That changed the complete experience of the game.
Yeah.
So for stuff that's designed for things like that, it really makes a total difference in the human experience of it, you know, because you got to think of a controller as an extension of yourself into the game. So it completely changes the way some of the games are approached and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I am not really a big fan of the arcade one-up cabinets.
Mm.
But I bought the one that they made that had like 12 Atari games in it, mm-hmm. with a trackball and a rotary dial. The rotary dial is really bad, but the trackball is okay. And it's just like there aren't a lot of ways to play those games, you know, Crystal Castles and Missile Command and Centipede and Millipede, with a proper trackball controller. So, you know, that does give the Arcade 1-Up cabinet some value. Just because it's such a rare experience to be able mm-hmm. to have that arcade experience at home.
It makes it way more fun mm-hmm. to actually be able to play that.
And Replicade also made like a 12-inch tall Centipede cabinet, which has a very tiny trackball, but that also
works.
It does, yeah. It's pretty decent.
Awesome. Yeah.
But otherwise, you have to play Centipede with a D-pad or, you know, analog stick, and it's just not the same. You know, you can get the Atari Classics Collection, I think, for most modern consoles. And it has analog support, but, you know, an analog stick is still not a trackball.
Yeah, it's not the same. It's just not the same.
Right. And so that's what we really want to talk about this episode is, you know, what makes trackball games so unique and fun, and what are they exactly? Like, how do they take advantage of the trackball?
I'll say one thing that's general about trackballs that's not in any other control form is that they have momentum. Mm-hmm. And they have the weight. So you throw a lot of weight to it, and it keeps spinning, and that's something that isn't replicated with an analog stick or something.
But in addition to the momentum and weight, you can also get incredible precision in 360 degrees of motion.
Yeah.
Or, you know, as many as the computer is programmed for.
Like really small movements or huge, mm-hmm. you know, sweeps.
It's like gross actions and also very precise, minute actions. And that's a very unique combination. And it does make the trackball really, really accessible.
That's because balls are gross.
See, there you go. Write in the jokes for us. All right, so let's go through the history of notable games. I went online and looked for the best possible list I could find of trackball games, and it turned out to be Wikipedia, so everyone mm-hmm. who hates Retronauts and says that we just quote Wikipedia, you're right, that's all we did this episode. Sorry, they were the best source.
We're podcasting on the run today.
Yep, it's just like, you know, you gotta, when something's comprehensive, that's what you gotta go with. But I did a lot of looking into some of these games that I hadn't heard of, and the history of trackball games actually apparently goes back to 1973, although I have some doubts about that.
I'm extremely skeptical about this.
So a 1973 game by Taito called Soccer, according to Giant Bomb, which is Wikipedia's source, it is the first ever trackball game. But I went on to Arcade Flyers, which is the only real decent source I could find of original material on this game, and the flyer is very low resolution, and it's in Japanese, but it does not appear to have a trackball in the cabinet. It looks like rotary dials.
Yeah, it's a and Pong it's clone.
Yeah.
So if, like, this is like rewriting the history of video games. If you went back in time and made a trackball game in 1973 that wasn't a Pong clone, it's like rewriting the whole history of arcade machines, because most games in 73 were Pong clones.
Yeah, well, I mean,
74, 75.
This was a Pong clone. It was basically like your soccer guys were two Pong paddles.
So I'm skeptical about this. I think I'd give it like a 5% chance of actually being true. Honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to read the Japanese flyer, and my Japanese literacy is very limited, but I looked very carefully and did not see any mention of trackball, which I think, or like spinner, or anything like that, like any English loan words that would be used on the Japanese flyer. And none of those appeared. It really, like, even in those tiny, low-resolution images, it really looks like it was a rotary dial game.
Yeah, I think so.
But it is notable because it was designed by the creator of Space Invaders, Tomohiro Nishikado, and he claims it was Japan's very first ever original video game.
Hmm.
So that's notable.
I mean, what if it could be real and extremely rare, and they made, like, 100 of them, and no one has a picture of it? And that would be amazing, but it's sort of undiscovered game that
Yeah. I mean, there are some cases further down this chronology where you'll find games that were made in variant versions with trackballs, but I don't think that's the case here. So we jump ahead to 1978 and a Midway game called Shuffleboard. So immediately you're going after the 60-year-old, like, cruise ship demographic.
Yeah. It's a good application for the trackball. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't played real shuffleboard, but I could imagine shuffling, like tossing a thing.
Well, in shuffleboard, you have like a stick. It's kind of like curling. Yeah.
Okay, yeah,
so you have a, basically like a triangle at the other end of the field, or whatever it's called, the lane. Mm-hmm. And the triangle is segmented. And basically, wherever you land the shuffle puck, I guess is what you call it, wherever you land the puck, you get points based on the point value of that segment of the triangle, but you take turns pushing the puck, and if someone knocks your puck out of that space, then you don't get points for being in that space. They do, because they landed in that space. So the game actually replicates that pretty well. I watched some videos of this. Like, I've never seen this game before in my in real life, but
it's probably extremely rare.
I imagine, yeah. It's 1978, so yep. Black and white, like, kind of pre-vector graphics, very primitive, but, you know, it had this kind of analog control interface, so that's, you know, kind of impressive and forward thinking.
Did this predate football?
It does.
To your knowledge?
Yes.
Cool.
But that is the next big one, is Atari's Football from 1979. Have you guys played this game?
No.
I almost feel like I have. I mean, there is actually a guy who I used to work with my first job who had a football machine, and he said I could have it or something. I was like, holy crap. And this was in the 90s. So he said he was going to give it to me, but he got fired.
And you didn't, like, show up at his house and was like, hey, sorry about your job, but can I have that football game?
The problem was I was a teenager, and I couldn't just show up at his house and pick it up kind of thing. I think I had a 6-speed Mazda 626 with a tiny trunk, and, I didn't. My parents may have helped me, but it wasn't.
Let me tell you about the time my now wife and I drove across the San Francisco Bay Bridge to Oakland, some little suburb, and bought a light table. You know, those big metal light tables that have illumination built in, mm-hmm. with a Honda Civic. And somehow got that back across the bridge. That was the scariest ride of my life. You could have done that, man.
Did you strap it into the trunk?
No, we strapped it to the top of the car. With a blanket underneath, and I was like holding it as we crossed back across the bridge, thinking, "Dear God, please don't let us slow down or like break suddenly."
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that if there is a will and a need for football, there is a way.
Yeah. Well, let's go back in time and help my 16-year-old.
Let's do that.
Go get it.
We can also check on that shuffleboard game, or not a shuffleboard, soccer game.
Yeah.
While we're back there, but no, I'm actually surprised that you guys don't seem to have encountered football. Is it just because you're younger than me?
Yeah. I mean, it's a rare game, and it wasn't in the...
Is it rare?
Yes. Now it is, yeah. I mean, there were arcades when I was a kid, probably, that still had it, some classic-type arcades, but we usually see in those arcades the classic era of color games that starts in 81 up to the mid to late 80s, you know, that kind of... And everything before this black and white sort of got decommissioned, and they probably didn't earn quarters.
You know what happened is I grew up in Texas, and football is everything there. So I remember when I was in, like, junior high, high school, and, you know, it was like the age of Street Fighter II. I still would find Atari football in arcades or even at, like, skating rinks.
Wow.
Like, it was just this perennial game. Yeah. And the game itself is incredibly basic. It's a top-down cocktail cabinet, two-person. You get, like, an overhead view of half the field, and the field scrolls as you play. And the players, it's black and white. Like a black field with white stripes, and the players are depicted as X's and O's, depending on the team. But, like, it was... I really think, you know, not having played shuffleboard or quote-unquote tennis, I really feel like it was the first game that really took advantage of the physicality of trackballs, because to make your running back run, basically, you were just rolling the ball as hard as you could, spinning it, and, like, really putting your body into it. So you had, you know, basically people taking turns, or not even taking turns, like they were playing simultaneously, mm-hmm. one trying to intercept the other, and just, like, you know, breaking a sweat to get their team to score a touchdown or prevent the other team from doing that. Yeah. So
I've seen it. I've seen videos of it, and I've heard that it was popular. I guess the guy who was going to give me that machine said his machine had been in a sports bar and was really popular or something.
Bet it smelled like beer.
Yeah.
Probably smelled like pee.
And balls.
I don't know about that, Binge.
Track balls, man.
Oh, okay.
Did it?
Yeah, no.
It smelled exactly like track balls.
Okay. The centipede multiplies and divides and comes after you from every side.
sight. Faster and faster, roll by roll, he slides through the rocks to get you from below. Oh, Santa Fe, you can't run away. You can't run away.
You can cut that part out.
No, we're keeping it. But then Atari, the same year, used the same technology, the same setup, to make a soccer game and a baseball game, which seems a little more difficult to do with a trackball, but I guess you fielded with the trackball.
I haven't seen that one.
I haven't either.
I know it exists, but I haven't seen video
of it. I did not know it existed. Yeah. Soccer and baseball are new on me, but football, I feel, was a big hit. It was everywhere. I've seen it at Midwest Gaming Classic, actually. Yeah. You need to go to Midwest Gaming Classic sometimes.
Have you? I still haven't been to that one.
You got
to
go.
I'm pretty sure I've seen the Atari football. I just haven't played it. The first arcade experience I remember, I was really, really young, but I was still, it was the late 80s. So, I wanted all that new technology, not something
right.
that was black and
Give
white.
Me something with color, thanks.
Right.
Maybe
I
more
think
than
it's too
two
much
bits.
To ask for a kid. I'm just like a new color.
I understand. I mean, even at the time when I saw it, I was like, this game is ancient. This is like 12 years old. What the hell?
Wasn't it only a cocktail form factor?
Because it was head-to-head.
Head-to-head, yeah.
Yeah, so it was only available in that format. But that's, perfect for bars, because you stick your beer down, and then you start spinning really fast, and you bump your beer over, and the bartender kicks you out, and you never come back again. Yeah. So the next big game is Centipede, which came the following year, also from Atari. I feel like you guys both have to have played this.
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right. Bob, you've been a little shut out of the conversation so far, so why don't you take the lead here?
Well, I mean, it's just the trackball games that I've interacted with came a little bit later. But for me, I do remember seeing Centipede, but I think I played it more later on in life on more of these, barcade-style places just to appreciate it. But I think everybody's played some form of Centipede at some point in their life on something, whether it's their cell phone, the trackball, anything else. And it's definitely a game that different interaction of it certainly changes the feel of the game as opposed to playing it with an arcade stick. Mm-hmm. But I have actually seen arcade stick versions of it, but
really?
It could have just been a hacked up, I think it was one of those, the arcade machines that came out in the early 2000s that were basically early MAME machine
style
things.
Yeah, pretty much,
It probably was. Yeah, I've never seen a stick version of Centipede.
That sounds atrocious.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole appeal of Centipede was that it was incredibly accessible to anyone. That is my mother's favorite game. She loves Centipede. And she's not a video game person at all. But it was just so intuitive. You have this bug coming down from the top of the screen, and you're a little thing at the bottom that's trying to shoot the bug before it gets to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you use the trackball, and it moves your gun guy, gnome, whatever he is, around the screen.
Yep.
And then you fire upward at the centipede, and it's very direct, and it gives you great, fine, precise control over the movement of your gnome, we'll call it. But you can zip all the way across the screen instantaneously, or you can just make incredibly fine maneuvers to adjust your aim. And it's great, and it's a really well designed game too.
It was designed by Donna Bailey, it was actually Atari's second female game developer, I think, and that probably explains why it was popular with women, because she's tapping into something that.
It's a really colorful game. It's very accessible. It's intuitive. It's basically Space Invaders or Galaga, but. Even though it's a game about shooting stuff, it doesn't feel violent.
It feels frantic, though, to me.
It does, yeah. There's a lot happening. Yeah, there's a lot happening, because the centipede comes down from the top of the screen, and it consists of balls, actually. And each time you... each time you shoot a segment,
the segment
turns into a mushroom, and then the centipede splits into other pieces. So you actually have to be really careful about how you attack the centipede, because if you, fire up and hit the middle of it, it's going to break into two pieces, and, it can break off all these little bits that'll come at you independently. Plus it's laying down mushrooms as you destroy it, and other mushrooms are popping up on the field and they block your shots. And then there's also fleas that fall down after you get to the second stage, and they create mushrooms in their wake.
And the spider.
And then there's the spider. who jumps in. And there's also the slug that crawls across the top, kind of as like the UFO from Space Invaders, but it has a little theme. And it creates mushrooms also as it crawls across. There's mushrooms everywhere.
And you get score based on the number of mushrooms you don't shoot.
At the
stage, yeah.
I didn't know that.
So you try to shoot as few mushrooms as you can and as many centipedes as you can.
Is it the mushrooms you don't shoot or mushrooms that are partly destroyed? Because mushrooms take like 3 or 4 hits to destroy.
Every mushroom left on the screen, it counts them up at the end of each round when you destroy the centipede.
Okay, I thought it was like, I thought that was the mushrooms regenerating.
No, it's actually counting it up for the score.
No kidding.
Yep.
Wow, so many specifics I did not know about.
Well, it's a cool game. I mean, this is one game where my grandpa was a barber in Texas in a very small town. And
He probably played football.
No. He was a cattle rancher and a barber and a World War II generation. And right next to his barbershop was a little laundromat that had a centipede machine in it. So when we went to Texas to visit him, we'd go play centipede. And that's one of my cool memories of that game.
Hmm. The other big game of 1980 that used a trackball was Missile Command, which you've already mentioned, but that's another one that I feel like you guys must have played.
Maybe I did play the arcade version of this one time. It was also sort of, unlike Centipede, which I've seen around a lot because it was a popular game, I haven't seen many Missile Command machines.
Missile Command stopped being relevant in like 1989, once the Soviet Union fell and we were no longer afraid of nuclear attacks. It is very much a game inspired by mutual assured destruction.
Mm-hmm.
It is a game that you cannot win, and that's by design. And it really taps into the Cold War paranoia and fear. You know, duck and cover under your school desk to protect yourself from a nuclear bomb kind of thing. And turns that into a video game.
Mm. Yeah, I don't ever remember playing that as a kid, but I certainly have as an adult, and I've been to some of the places that have it. And again, it's just another unique experience that's, you know, it's a simpler game, of course. It's not like some of the more advanced games out there, but I think games like that have a certain appeal because there's no learning curve, really. You just kind of figure it out right mm-hmm. Right when you put your quarter in, pretty much. And I do think that's another game that just wouldn't be the same at all without the trackball. I just didn't really
Although
enjoy
I did,
it.
I did play it as a kid with a joystick on the Atari 800, and it was still kind of fun, but it's nowhere near as fun without the trackball.
Yeah, it's also a very frantic game, but in a different way than Centipede. So the idea of Missile Command is you have, I think, 3 or 4 missile bases at the bottom, like cities, basically.
Yeah.
Is it 5? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's 5.
You have multiple like cities at the bottom of the screen that you're trying to defend from missile attacks that are coming from the top of the screen, and they come from sort of all angles.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, if a missile makes it all the way down to your city, it destroys your city, and when you lose all 5 cities, that's it. And each missile is basically just a tracked line. It's a vector game, right?
No, it's not.
It's not? Okay, no, it's right, because the explosions are filled. But it has that kind of vector look to it, sort of like Defender or, you know, Robotron 2084. It has that, like, really crisp, almost kind of Williams style to it.
The single pixel lines. There must have been enough resolution to make those tiny little lines be pretty sharp, yeah.
So basically what you do is you use the trackball to control a targeting reticle that you move across the screen, and when you hit the fire button, a missile will launch from your bases toward the point that your cursor is at. And when it hits that point, then it explodes into a circle. And anything that hits the circle then explodes, it detonates into another circle. You can create these really cool chain reactions, but basically you're just trying to like lay down a field of fire to prevent the enemy missiles from coming through.
Yeah.
And
you have a limited number of missiles, too.
You do. And also the missiles grow faster and faster and much more numerous as you advance through the game.
It's terrifying. I've heard that people were terrified by this game because of that. Obviously, the Cold War paranoia about... It wasn't paranoia. It was the real threat of nuclear annihilation. And there's at the end of that game, it says the end.
Yeah, it's not game over. It's the end.
Yeah, like the end of the world.
Like the screen explodes.
Yeah.
So,
it's
yeah.
Deep. It's heavy.
Mr. Gorbachev, please empty that coin bucket. those are kind of the big ones. Missile Command and Centipede. Those are, I would say, timeless games that, maybe Missile Command's not quite so much, but it's still very playable even now. But they're games that grew larger in the collective conscious than most other video games of the era. Like, they weren't quite up there with Pac-Man and Donkey Kong, but they were pretty close. Like, in, you know, 1982, 83, if you said Missile Command, like, someone would know what that was, in addition to Space Invaders.
Yeah, so. Missile Command was a huge hit. In fact, General Computer Corporation who went on to hack Pac-Man into Ms. Pac-Man and design the Atari 7800, got their start making a missile command, an unauthorized missile command hack board or something like that to make it more difficult.
Oh, yeah, because that's what we needed, was a harder missile command.
It just means there was a big enough market out there of machines to sell it to arcade operators to extend the lifespan. So it must have been a pretty big hit at that time.
I mean, there are games that are still sold today, and the touchscreen cell phone versions of them, I think, do a pretty good job of mimicking the different kind of control scheme. You know, use your finger to scroll across the touchscreen in the same way. So obviously they're important enough games in history that they're still being sold today.
Yeah, and Replicate has been showing off a replica 12-inch mini missile command cabinet. They also had one last year at Portland Retro Gaming Expo that was a reproduction of the sit-down cabinet, although it wouldn't actually be playable because you have to like reach inside and spin the spinner like inside the tiny sit-down cabinet. But it's cool that they're like, hey, remember this thing? Probably not, but it existed and we made a fake version of it. So I'm looking forward to that coming out, the real Missile Command mock-up.
I'm looking forward to trying it. I think those companies up until now have really just wanted to give as affordable of an experience for those old games as possible, but didn't put a lot of time and effort into quality or accuracy or anything. But I've heard at least one of those companies is really trying to make strides to go in the opposite direction, and while keeping them affordable, not having a clunky spinner, not requiring.
Yeah, that's more like Replicate, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
like Arcade 1-Up is doing better, but I feel like Replicate, considering the form factor, the size of those machines, I think they're very good for what they are.
Yeah.
Like, they're made of very good materials, and they run, quote-unquote, bespoke emulators, whatever that is. But the games seem faithful and accurate, and they're very playable, and they'll save your high score and so forth. So, like, it's good quality stuff. You know, they've got light-up marquees, and they've got the little accurate Atari buttons, the little cones with the red lights on the end, and those light up when you turn on the machine. So they even come with tiny little quarters, like 1/6 replica scale quarters that you can put in the change bucket. They have a USB charger that just came out from a Kickstarter, and the USB charger that you can plug all the machines into is designed to look like a 1980s change machine with the wood grain and everything. There's a lot of love put into those. So that's one of the reasons I'm looking forward to Missile Command from them, because I feel like it'll be fun to play even when it's tiny.
Yeah, you can assemble your entire Barbie-sized arcade.
Yeah, absolutely. Arcade. Was Barbie 1/6 scale?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I mean, I've seen that thing.
Oh, yeah, she made out with G.I. Joes.
Sort of,
right, sure.
Yeah,
okay.
Basic. Maybe a little small. So the next game on the list.
Moving on, the next game is Kick. Have you guys ever played this? I had never heard of this before today.
You haven't? I love Kickman.
Really?
So I mostly know Kickman from a third-party clone on the Atari 800 called Pinhead.
Okay.
And I forgot who developed it, but it's a really fun game. And I learned later that it was a clone of Kickman. And when I was a teenager and I wanted to buy an arcade machine, somebody was selling a Kickman arcade machine, I almost convinced my parents to buy it for me.
Really?
For $200 or something. Man, I really wish I got it.
Yeah, that would have been a good deal at this point.
Yeah. And I was going to get like Gauntlet and Ms. Pac-Man for a couple $100. It would have been a great idea, but we didn't have the room to store that stuff.
That is the problem with big arcade cabinets. That's why I like the foot-tall
ones. Tiny ones.
Yeah.
But Kickman, the premise is that there's rows of balloons at the top of the screen, and they're fall down one or two at a time, and you're a guy on a unicycle who has to either pop them with your head, like a pin on the top of your head, helmet or hat or whatever it is, or you can kick as they come down and catch them and kick them back up to try to pop them when they come back down. And so it's challenging, but we played Pinhead like crazy, and the arcade is basically the same premise.
Yeah, the
Kickman,
instead of popping them with your head, they just stack up on their head. So it gets harder and harder to catch more as more and more stack up.
Okay.
But this is interesting to me because it's one of, I think it might be Midway's first unauthorized use of Pac-Man. Like, when I say unauthorized, they mean they licensed Pac-Man from Namco, but Namco definitely did not sign off on this because some of the balloons are Pac-Man ghosts, and then there's one that is Pac-Man. And when the Pac-Man balloon comes down, he'll like eat everything on your head.
Yeah, that was in Pinhead too. And there was a mode in Pinhead where the balloons would stack up real high, and you then they'd go and stuff. So I don't know, maybe they didn't have the pin in the arcade one, but I had no idea that was a trackball game. That's interesting.
Yeah, apparently I looked it up and I found photos of the arcade cabinet and it does have a trackball.
Cool.
But I feel like most of the games that came out following these were pretty much derivative. Like Laserbase from Amstar in 1981 is basically a mix of Space Invaders and Missile Command.
Yeah, I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, it's not that interesting looking. It's just like, oh, yeah, they basically took two very popular games and combined them and use a trackpad. There's a... or trackball. There is a weird game called Beezer from a developer called Tong.
Tong?
Never heard of.
Yeah.
And it's a very complicated game because you have this screen full of these like three-sided gates and you rotate them around by like basically moving a little character who is your icon and he spins them. And your goal is to rotate the gates to the point that they all form a hexagon. And you're trying to trap bees in those hexagons to destroy them while the bees are chasing you and trying to destroy you. It seems very complicated and not very fun, but what do I know?
Yeah, well, bees always try to destroy me, so I hate this game.
Yeah, I mean, since I haven't heard of Beezer, I'm going to assume it was not very successful at doing what it did.
Yeah.
More successful was Millipede, the sequel to Centipede, which just basically added more stuff to the mix, including DDT bombs, which kind of work like the missile explosions in Missile Command. Like, when you hit a DDT bomb, it will... create like a little puff of gas and anything that runs into it will be destroyed. So it's kind of like the missiles in Missile Command.
Yeah, we're talking about Millipede?
Yeah.
I remember the DDT bombs.
There was a game called Liberator, which was based on DC's Atari Force comics, which was by Atari.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like Missile Command, that you're controlling a cursor, but you're like above a planet. And there's a very cool effect of the planet rotating beneath you, but it doesn't look that remarkable otherwise. So one of the more interesting games that I came across, which actually I have on that Arcade 1-Up cabinet, but I've never tried, is called Quantum, which kind of reminds me of Quix, in that you use the trackball to basically draw lines around these moving objects. And you're trying to avoid the lead point of the line from being hit by the moving objects, some of which are just there to be dangerous and some of which are there to be captured. But it seems kind of cool. Okay-ish. There was also a reactor from Gottlieb, the Qbert people. It has the little Qbert voices in it. It seems very complicated as you're circling a nuclear reactor core that is melting down and expanding while trying to avoid the reactor walls and like bump things into the coolant cores, the carbon, you know, rods. To
totally lighthearted game here.
Yeah. Really, really no leaning pressure. Into the Three Mile Island thing.
No pressure.
Very, very good escapism. There was a game called Slither, which is basically Centipede, except instead of killing centipedes in a garden, you're killing snakes in the Wild West. Video games in the early 80s were very mean to
wildlife,
yes.
Bees and snakes.
1982 and 83 brought us Birdie King and Birdie King 2, which, despite the names, you're not killing birds. These are golf games. And I think this is one of the places where the... kind of like Atari's football, the trackball sort of found its natural inclination towards sports games.
Mm-hmm.
This was before Sega and Nintendo basically invented the swing meter for golf games.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of using a swing meter, you basically just use the trackball to determine the direction and the force of the ball when you hit it. So that seems good.
Seems like an intuitive way to understand it.
Anyway, the next big game was Crystal Castles. The game's so big, they named a band after it. So you guys have any experience with Crystal Castles?
I vaguely remember seeing it at some arcades at some museums or stuff like the Long Island Retro Gaming Expo that has a lot of the old collections.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely don't remember this as a kid.
I played it in the arcade, I'm pretty sure.
What do you think?
It's fun. It's frantic and fast. It's sort of like Pac-Man. You're collecting dots, right? But
you
go up and down, isometric kind
of... It's like Pac-Man meets Congo Bongo.
Yeah.
It's got the isometric viewpoint and the like the raised elevations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of doing a lot. And you basically control a bear who is a wizard, apparently.
Bentley Bear.
He's named after a car, but he's a wizard.
Yeah.
And he moves around on these pathways collecting gems. And your goal is, just like in Pac-Man, to collect all the gems, clear out the maze. But it is really fast. And, you know, because it's a trackball game, it can afford to be fast. But it seems really stressful to me. I never really played it. I've seen it, you know, many times through the years.
It's fast.
I've only played it a little bit. Yeah,
it's like really it's just hard to do precise.
Yeah.
When you're going so fast.
Right, but, and then you get into areas where, like, you're just surrounded by enemies and there's these platforms that move up and down, like little elevators.
Yeah.
And that's great, but you have to wait for the elevator to come down before you can step on it and take you to safety. Uh-huh. And some areas are, like, guarded by trees. And occasionally you can get honey or a wizard hat that'll, you know, give you special powers and briefly let you destroy the enemies. But otherwise, it's very challenging.
Yeah, glorified 3D isometric Pac-Man. Not really 3D, but...
I mean, to me, it kind of reminds me of a lot of the games that were really popular in the UK around this time on microcomputers, like the stuff by Ultimate Play the Game that became Rare. You know, that isometric style. I don't know who inspired whom or if it was just like both groups of people just kind of stumbling onto an idea simultaneously, but...
what was the game you said it was like Pac-Man plus what? The isometric?
Pac-Man plus... What did I say? Good lord.
I was right.
Congo Bongo. Yeah,
I think that may have
Sega's Donkey Kong clone.
I think that game invented the isometric viewpoint, or close to it, you know?
There may have been
others, but that was popular.
Yeah, I think that was 82, right?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, so this was 83, so that would make sense.
I will say about Crystal Castles, the Bentley Bear became a weird mascot for Atari Corporation after the split.
When
Jack Tramiel bought the company. For some reason, I think they retained the rights to Bentley Bear while the other arcade properties were owned by the arcade division. And so they had these Bentley Bear spelling games and stuff for the Atari ST in the 80s. And when they made Atari carts for the Jaguar, Bentley Bear is one of the controllable characters. It's like the only Atari character they could put in there.
I totally forgot all about that.
What system was Atari carts on?
Jaguar.
I've never heard of this one.
Yeah.
Oh, it was super late.
It was at the end, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a pretty bad Mario Kart clone.
I bet. Most Mario Kart clones are pretty bad.
That's true.
The funny thing is, still one of the best Jaguar games, because there aren't very many great Jaguar games, even though it's not a great game. You know. I wanted it so
bad. Beats Trevor McFur.
Yeah, it's way better than Trevor.
How come Bentley Bear wasn't in Trevor McFur?
I don't know.
Was Trevor McFur in Atari Karts?
No. I don't know why. That started as a Panther game, one of their 32-bit console that they're working on. Anyway, that's a whole other story.
We can do an episode on Jaguar someday. It'll be 10 minutes long, but it'll be very informative.
Yeah, I know lots. I bought the Jaguar when it's new, so I got lots to say about that.
So earlier I mentioned that there were some games that came in variants that had trackballs, and one of those is Konami's Track and Field. I think most people know this game, but you probably know it from the original version, which had buttons that you hammered or like used a spoon or used some sort of makeshift mechanism to cheat. Apparently that was really, really hard on the consoles, the arcade cabinets. And after a certain point, Konami was like, arcade runners are getting really angry because we're selling them these game systems and they're being destroyed by over-enthusiastic users. So they replaced the buttons with a trackball. From what I read about this, it makes the game way easier, so people don't like it as much.
I've only seen the button one. There's a boxcar in Raleigh, a classic barcade thing. They have a Track and Field with buttons.
I remember seeing both versions.
Okay.
Although I can't place where or when. I just do remember seeing both versions. And I can't remember which I saw first, but I remember seeing the second and going, hey, wasn't that game, you know, a trackball game? Or, you know, wasn't it a stick game? Why is this a trackball? But it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I honestly had never heard of this before I started doing research on this, but I, you know, took some time and read forum posts by people who are like, yeah, I've played it. It's real. It's a thing. So they, you know, it existed, but generally people's opinion was not favorable. They were like, I'd rather play the button version and get calluses or, you know, mess up the machine somehow. But it is a fun little quirk of history, I guess. So one of the other big trackball games throughout history is Marble Madness from 1984, which wasn't that the very first Atari Games game?
Could be, yeah.
Once Atari Games and Atari Inc. split.
Yeah.
After the sell-off from Warner.
Yeah, it was Atari Corporation and Atari Games.
Yeah.
Atari Inc. was before they split.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Atari Corp.
Yeah. Atari Corp. Yeah, I think you're right. Marvel Games, Marvel Madness may have been the first, or Gauntlet.
No, Gauntlet was 85.
Okay, 85, yeah.
And
so
Marble Madness was 84, so...
Marble Madness is a cool game.
It is.
I used to play it at the movie theater.
I remember playing it for... I'm 99% sure I owned the NES version of it.
Okay.
I remember absolutely loving it. And I don't think any of the arcades in there where I lived had an arcade version. Or if it did, maybe I was just young and passed by it because I owned the NES version and just figured I could play that at home. Let me go to Afterburner or something crazy. But I remember maybe 4 or 5 years ago seeing a Marble Madness cabinet with the trackball in it. And it blew my mind. As much as I really enjoyed the NES version, and I tried my hardest to, you know, get as many levels in as I could, it completely changed the dynamic of the game. And I think it's one of the games that truly demonstrates the difference between a trackball and a controller. And the fact that your character in Marble Madness is a marble and you're spinning a trackball gives you that sensation that you really are kind of controlling the ball on the screen, even though it obviously doesn't match exactly to how it's rolling. And one would argue it's not nearly as accurate as even like Centipede, but I just thought that was a game that completely changed when I found the trackball version. And I don't think I could go back. I think I'd have to, get a trackball and use it through emulation, or maybe, you know, find an original arcade board or something. But I just found the game so much more enjoyable when you're actually rolling a ball, mimicking a ball rolling on the screen.
Yeah, we haven't really talked about what Marble Madness is. Like, what you roll a marble, but what's so interesting about that?
Try to reach a goal, I think, and you have to not fall off the screen or fall into pits and traps and stuff. I don't remember.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
there's
so
obstacles in the way.
So yeah, the thing that makes it interesting is that it has like the way Crystal Castles was isometric, mm-hmm. or you know, force projection or whatever. It takes that idea and then creates even more topographic variance in the field. So in addition to like going down ramps and moving across platforms, there's also gaps that you have to roll really fast to get across and then kind of stop yourself so you don't go off the other side. Mm-hmm. In Crystal Castles, the edges of the platforms are safe. Like, you never have to worry about falling into a pit, but here you do.
Yeah.
Like, the marble can go right off the edge. And even within, like, flat areas, there will be depressions or little rises. So your marble is basically never still. Like, there's not really any flat ground in this game.
Yeah.
And when there is flat ground, then it's probably not safe because there's probably, like, objects rising out of the ground that'll knock you into the hole, or like little hammers that'll, you know, send you flying in other directions. So it's basically an obstacle course with tons of geometry that affects the movement of your marble.
And terrain.
Yeah, the geometry of the terrain is the other factor that I thought was really neat, because like even in the first level, it's like it's almost goes into a track. Like, imagine like a bowling. You know, if you get your ball in the gutter, that's kind of what the start of the first level is like. But you start at the top of a hill, if you will, and go down this. And, you know, the speed of the ball makes a big difference for certain things. Like you were saying, the jump going over certain areas or slowing down. And when you have the trackball control, you know, you get that sensation of, like, okay, let me slowly roll this ball, both literally and figuratively, let's roll this ball across the screen. And then you get to the jumps and you gotta go, you know, really fast and spin it up, and you get the sensation of both, you know, that the marble is really moving down this track of geometry, and that you get to have to control the aspects around it.
Yeah, it's a great game, and it's notably was designed by Mark Cerny, who went on to design the hardware for PlayStation 4 and I guess 5?
Probably,
he's a big guy at Sony now.
Hmm.
So there's a kind of a legacy there.
He's a nice guy, too.
Is he?
For some reason, I've emailed him before, and we talked about something, and he was nice.
That's good.
Thanks, Mark.
It's nice when our heroes are nice.
Yeah. Cool guy.
Another game that is kind of it came as a surprise to me when I was researching is Blades of Steel, the Konami hockey game. I've only ever played that on NES, so I had no idea that in the arcades you controlled your hockey dudes with a trackball.
Yeah, I didn't know it had a trackball until we were researching this episode, actually, because... you know, it was really famous on the NES. I bet it was a blast on the arcade with the trackball.
Probably.
It looks really fun.
The characters are so big, too.
Yeah.
Like, it was a very lively-looking game.
Yeah, and the fight sequence looks really graphically
brutal.
Cool.
Brutal, man. Yeah, I also don't think I've ever tried the trackball version, but now, because I have played the NES version a lot as a kid, I didn't own it, but I had a friend that was a big TV fan that loved it. So now I got to go try that on me and see what that's like.
Yeah, yeah, I love the NES version, but they should make a Street Fighter 2 hockey game where you start fighting.
Street hockey?
Into, yeah, turns into combat.
So another one that is one of those variant versions is the game Cabal, which I think was Konami, right? Came before Devastators, or was that some other company? I can't remember. But in any case, it's one of those like into the screen fixed shooters where you're running around at the bottom of the screen and basically moving a cursor around, but also moving your guy around along with the cursor, trying to avoid bullets while shooting things in the field. And apparently the original version of that was trackball based, and they replaced it with a joystick. Huh. That's the only version I've ever seen.
I wonder why. Just costs. They already have a bunch of joysticks in
there. It's a mystery.
Territory, so
yeah, I don't know. Around the same time, Capcom shipped Capcom Bowling, which, as far as I can tell, is the first trackball-based bowling game.
Huh.
And it's surprising that it took 10 years for anyone to create a trackball-based bowling game, because it seems perfect.
Yeah.
Again, it's like Marble Madness. You have a ball, and you're controlling it. And the speed and force with which you roll determines, you know, your throw and the lane. So
it makes sense for a perfect bowling interface.
Yeah. Yeah, there would be lots of other trackball-based bowling games to come, including probably most famously The Simpsons Bowling, which came in the year 2000. Even, you know, like, The Simpsons were still a thing back then.
Simpsons were always a thing.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So yeah, we're kind of wrapping up the history of notable trackball games here. In 1990, Atari made what was I would argue the last great trackball game, Rampart.
Oh yeah.
Have you guys played this one?
Yeah.
It's like a turn-based strategy game turned into a like 3-minute arcade experience. It's really amazing.
Yeah, me and my brother used to play this in Gatlinburg, as I always mention.
Ah yes, Marla. Gatlinburg. I've heard of that place.
Yeah, the arcades in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Had Rampart, and you can play, I think, up to 3 people at the same time.
Yep.
And so you have a phase where you're building your castle, and you're positioning the pieces on the screen like Tetris pieces of castle walls.
And yeah, so basically there's like a shoreline, and then there's a body of water. And yeah, so there are like 5 possible castles you can fortify.
Yeah, I guess you... Do you pick one?
You pick one, yeah.
And then you... Yeah, there's a fortification phase, and then there's a place your cannons phase, I think,
mm-hmm.
where you place them inside your walls. And you can only place them where you complete an entire wall and enclose.
Yeah, if you don't enclose your castle, then in the time, like the 20 seconds you get, then it's game over.
Yeah.
Kind of like SimCity for castle building, almost.
Kind of.
And then... do you want me to keep describing
the
gameplay?
Sure, go for it.
Just the next phase is that... It switches to an action phase where you are positioning your cannon, aiming your cannon, I think with a reticle probably, toward mm-hmm. your enemy's walls to destroy them and destroy the cannon as fast as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Sorry. Yeah, the first time I discovered that game was only a few years ago, and at first I didn't like it because I was like, this is an arcade game, but like this feels more like something I would want to sit home and play. And a friend of mine was with me who's not normally into that style of game, and she was just like, no, let's keep playing. This is kind of fun. And then we got sucked into it, and, you know, pumped a couple quarters in it. And it was neat, too, that it was such a long experience, especially at a time where, you know, arcades were meant to be like a 2-minute experience to get more quarters unless you were really good at the game. And I just thought it was neat that one credit each had what was essentially a very long arcade experience for each. But
I felt that way, too. It did seem like a lot of gameplay for a quarter or whatever credit.
But, you know, because it was up to 3 people at a time, they could afford to be generous, I think.
Yeah, so you're putting like,
and it also gets really challenging once you get to like the third phase. Like before long, you have just a fleet of ships coming at you, and then if the ships manage to make landfall, then they send little tanks out, and those will keep you from putting down your fortifications.
I thought that was just in the single player game. There's ships.
Otherwise,
I thought it was just player versus player.
Oh, is it? It's been a while since I played player versus player.
Yeah, there's a single player that has ships or something.
But
I've also played the Tengen version on the NES. It's okay, you know. Nowhere as cool as the arcade one.
Yeah, it's a great game. You know, it's like I said, it's basically a turn-based strategy game condensed into a 5-minute arcade experience, which is that's a remarkable feat, I think.
Yeah.
So also the same year was probably the most successful latter-day trackball game of all time, a series that is still around 30 years later, and that is Golden Tee Golf, which kind of takes that older golf game, which was by, who was that by?
Sega? Birdie King. Sega?
Yes, Birdie King.
Yeah, it was not a Sega game. Sorry.
I can't remember who it was by, but it took that concept and basically turned it into a more realistic golf sim with more contemporary graphics, and it's become a monster, like a perennial presence in bars, because drunk dudes go and they can maybe not control a video game so well and play Street Fighter, but they can spin a trackball, by God.
Yeah.
So, they keep making sequels, and there was an arcade one-up, like, Golden Tee Golf collection that came out, I think, last year?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, it's, like, got four different versions on it, I think.
They also made a plug-and-play TV games one that was fun. I have it that you just plug into it takes batteries, and you plug it into a TV. And so the neat thing is you pull the ball back to sort of, you know, pull back your swing, and then you push it forward as fast as you can, plus the angle of direction influences how you, whether you slice the ball or how far you hit it.
Yeah, it makes for a really fast-paced golf experience, faster than using swing meters and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's just like super immediate, super physical, tactile, very, very satisfying.
Yep.
And a game that you absolutely could just walk up and learn immediately, and you don't have to be a gamer to enjoy.
Yep.
I definitely think Golden Tee Golf could probably go down as the best trackball game ever, just because of its longevity and because of its how many people have played it. And while it might not actually be the best game ever made around a trackball, it's something that so many people have experienced. I have distinct memories of, it must have been, if this is 1990 when it was released, it must have been right when it came out, but I definitely have memories of going to a family-friendly sports bar with my dad on Sundays to watch football on the big projection screens and playing Golden Tee Golf. And I also remember the original, whenever you'd pull back and you'd go forward, it didn't, for whatever reason, usually the hole cut in the arcade machine was just a little bit too big and your skin would kind of get caught in there and pinch. So you'd have to make sure to, like, swoop over the trackball and then pull your hand up at the same time, because if you let it go around, you'd always get, like, I'd get my little hand squished in the side there, and it was never damaging, but it pinched, it stuck, it stunk. No one wanted to do that.
Alright, so Golden Tee Golf may be the best trackball game, but you know what isn't? That's Sega Sonic the Hedgehog from 1993. It's not a bad game, it's just kind of weird. It's basically Sonic the Hedgehog is an infinite runner, sort of, before there was such a thing. It's not really an infinite runner, but
it's a finite runner.
It is. It's a finite runner.
Yeah.
For up to three people, which is interesting. You can play as Sonic and Ray and Knuckles and probably some other people. But
Kylo Ren?
No Kylo Ren yet. Nope. You're thinking of the Sonic sequel trilogy. But basically, it's a series of isometric levels where there's always something chasing after you, and you're using the trackball to go as quickly as you can, trying not to fall off platform edges, evading traps, getting onto, like, these spinning tracks that open doors.
Wow.
It seems very busy, very complicated, very stressful.
Yeah, I've never played it. I've seen it, but it's such an obscure thing. I think it was only Japan, right?
I think so, yeah.
I think I played it when I was going through, I had built a main machine a while ago and made sure to add different, the ability to add different controllers to it. And I think I went through and went, oh, Sonic, I didn't know there was another Sonic arcade game. I know there was a few, but I remember playing it for about 5 minutes and going, nah, nope, never mind.
Did you play with a trackball?
I think I may have. I think I probably did, because I did have a trackball hooked up to this one machine.
Yeah,
so
there was
that's how.
There was a little sidebar you added to the notes about MAME trackballs. I don't know if you wanted to talk about that at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's anybody that's ever used MAME on any platform knows that it's pretty much an excellent way to experience all of these older arcade games, especially when you don't have the ability to find original arcade boards, build them up, add the controls. And a few different times in my life, I've built MAME machines, and as with my usual OCD of making sure it's as accurate as you can get. And one of the things that I had done was adding a trackball to a controller I had, and I ended up using that even for driving games, like OutRun. That's one of my favorite racing games of all time. And I even tried using it with Tempest, which, while, I really want an original Tempest machine because of vector graphics and a cool spinner, it was a better way to play both of those games than a stick.
Right.
So it's not nearly as good as the keyboard. Wheel or that, yeah, or a keyboard or anything, but being able to use those definitely improved the experience. And I think anybody that's really going through and building a MAME machine, or I guess even just wants to try MAME on a computer, just pick up, if it's just on your PC, maybe pick up a trackball from Amazon and see. But if you're actually building a controller, they're less than $100, but you can actually have one so you can build it right into something. And I believe the outputs are USB or PS2, so depending on how you want to interface it. But I found it really to add a lot to the experience. So even just for things that, you know, were 100% accurate to the original, it's still infinitely better than trying to use a stick for it.
So, you're a big proponent of Mister. How is Mister for trackball support? Does it have it yet? Because there are some arcade cores. I know Gyrus, I guess that's not a trackball game, but that's a spinner game.
I believe it does, because Mister supports keyboard and mouse, and it also supports a spinner controller, because I believe Arkanoid was ported to the Mister, and it's apparently an incredibly accurate port as well. So I imagine a trackball has, I should talk to the team to double check and maybe give that a try, but as long as it's USB based, it should work perfectly. But that's the short version for anyone that's not aware of Mister. It's basically a way of emulating these games that's similar to MAME, but on emulating on a hardware level. So while it doesn't have the thousands of games MAME does, the games it does have are pretty darn accurate to the original. You know, no lag added, good output, analog and digital signals and all that stuff. So anytime there's a new game on Mister, I do a new game that I've played before or had interest in, I try to give it a try. And Arkanoid was a very cool port.
Mister is amazing. I just got a Mister board a few months ago, and it's an incredible project. It's one of the best things that's ever happened to video game preservation. In my opinion, yeah.
I think the best would probably have to be MAME.
Yeah.
And then hopefully, you know, MAME's, what, 20 plus years old? So
yeah, it's really
hopefully 20 plus years from now, Mister will have been the root of all this.
Yeah, I mean, Mister is basically, like I said in the Mister episode we did, it's basically kind of following the track of MAME, but as a hardware solution. So, yeah, I can see that happening.
It's awesome.
All right, finally, we'll end up with a game that really kind of describes my life, and that is The Irritating Maze. Yeah, so I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Irritating Phenomenon franchise, whatever it was, from the late 90s.
Not at all, no.
There was basically a Japanese TV show, I think, a game show, where people had to maneuver through a maze that was electrified, and they turned this into video games, and there was Irritating Stick for PlayStation.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was also this arcade game, which I don't know if it was based on the show or it was just kind of inspired by it, but it was a trackball game with a spinner, and you had to maneuver a marble through a maze, avoiding obstacles, avoiding the electrical walls and so forth. And
kind of like Operation, but you're rolling a ball through it rather than putting your...
Trackball Operation.
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. Anyway, so that's pretty much it. Like, there haven't been really any significant new trackball games that I can think of in the past 20-odd years.
No, just more versions of Golden Tee Golf.
Yeah, which isn't new. It's the same thing, and it's nice that they're still making it. But, yeah, no one's really innovated with that concept in a long time, at least that I'm aware of. If I'm mistaken, please inform us by social media so we can know more about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is Retronauts, so it's fine to talk about old stuff instead of new stuff. Anyway,
absolutely.
Thanks, guys, for taking time to... brave Ted Med and all the noise behind us. Hopefully it's still a tolerable episode and isn't too messy. I feel bad for our editor, but you know, that's the breaks, that's the life you live.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. Absolutely an honor to join you guys in this. So
yeah, to wrap up, why don't you introduce yourself? We can all introduce ourselves and tell people where to find us.
I am Bob, the founder of RetroRGB, and you can find anything to do with the website at RetroRGB everywhere. And, of course, just RetroRGB.com.
Do you have, like, a Patreon or anything?
I do. I'm on both Floatplane and Patreon.
I've never heard of Floatplane.
Floatplane is like Patreon, but by the line is Tech Tips Crew. So, by tech nerds for tech nerds.
I see.
It's, but, yeah, just anywhere at RetroRGB you can find us. And any support you give keeps all of the research and development and, of course, articles and podcasts that we have going.
Awesome.
That's awesome. And I'm Benj Edwards. You can find me on Twitter at Benj Edwards, and now I'm writing for How To Geek. You can read howtogeek.com and support my work there. I'm just starting to do some history-related things there that I've done really well, like about the Zip Drive and the Konami code the other day.
Yeah. Very sad about, what was his name? Hashimoto?
Yeah, something like that.
Passed away, the creator of the Konami code and many other video games.
Yeah, poor guy.
But yes, and then finally, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You know me from Retronauts. You'll also find me at Limited Run Games making things, media, and stuff like that, and being serenaded by probably lovely ladies in the background, because that's just the life that I lead, an exciting life of podcasts and chanteuses. Anyway, you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, and you can support Retronauts at patreon.com/retronauts for $3 a month. You get the podcast early every Monday, a week early, ahead of everyone else, the hoi polloi, using their iTunes feeds. And for $5 a month, you get bonus Friday episodes every other Friday, plus weekly articles written by Diamond Fight that are very informative and very personal. So check that out. It's worth it, in my opinion. And you know that I am not biased because I am no longer a journalist. Anyway, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back again in a week with a podcast, because that's how we roll. So, for this segment, I am talking to another author of classic gaming books, one that I'm actually a little envious of, because he's put together some really amazing stuff. Go ahead and introduce yourself, and I can talk more about how I envy your access in your work.
Well, my name's Tim Laptino, and I am a writer and also really creative director, and I've worked on and written the Art of Atari book, and also worked on the Undisputed Street Fighter book for Dynamite.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen the Street Fighter book, but I own Art of Atari, and it's just an amazing piece. It's like the access you got there, and the quality of the reproduction, the interviews with artists and illustrators is really some amazing stuff. I'd love to just talk to you. Maybe it's kind of inside pool for most people listening to this, inside baseball, whatever you call it. But like just the process of creating something like that and curating such, important, but also such old video game history seems like a daunting task.
It was. And I think if I knew how much work it was going to be at the beginning, I don't know if I would have undertaken as much of it. But, it came about in a really, really unusual way, because my day job is that I'm a creative director and a designer. I do packaging work. I do logos and brand identity in addition to writing. And I grew up with Atari, the Atari 2600, and the Atari logo was always one that really interested me. And, as a logo designer, there's this pantheon of logos, the Nike logo, the Apple, the rainbow Apple logo with a bite taken out of it. The logos of that era are well known, and their origin stories are kind of almost mythical, in the logo design circles. But I realized that the Atari logo, no one was talking about it. There wasn't really much written about it. There wasn't really much known about it. And so I started looking around on my own, trying to figure out who was this guy who designed the Atari logo. And his name was George Opperman. And he was, one of the creative forces at Atari. And so all of my research really started there.
Yeah, so how did you get into, you know, writing about video games in the first place? I mean, it's kind of a, you talked a little bit about, you know, sort of your background, but to go from creative design to saying I'm going to make a book about video game history, that's a big step. I had been writing about video games online myself for probably 20 years before I said, oh, I should do a book.
Yeah, you know, I think if I thought about it that way and sort of the way actual professional video game writers do things, I might not have done it. But I think, you know, for me, it was really, I didn't set out to write, you know, about video game history. I was really writing about the intersection of the things that I knew and the things I liked, right? So I wanted to write about art and design. And because that's what I do, right? But I was also really interested in the history of Atari. So, you know, that sort of led me into this very specific, you know, sort of chute, you know, that I slid down of video game history, which was, you know, there's many, many people who know way more about the history of video games, but really even the history of Atari. But what I found myself doing and sort of starting to look into the marketing and the design and the artwork in the historical Atari company, I realized that those were things that I knew about and no one else had gone there. So, you know, I was sort of treading new ground, and that was a place where I could actually, you know, carve out a little space, but not trying to be the expert at those other things that already sort of, you know, had been covered somewhat extensively, you know, in a couple other books. So I really looked at it as saying, you know what, I'm finding the intersection of art and design and creativity. Sorry. So, you know, if you sort of held me to the floor, I would say it is video game history, but I really saw it as a, you know, an art and design history about Atari.
Yeah, and, you know, I think specifically with that generation of consoles, the, you know, people talk about like the technology and the game design, but the marketing, the packaging design was so essential to the experience because the games themselves were so abstract. That you kind of relied on, you know, like seeing, oh, I've got a stick and there's a square that I'm hitting back and forth. Well, you know, you see like a painting of an astronaut like guiding a paddle through space, and all of a sudden Breakout becomes like this science fiction odyssey as opposed to just like, you know, some blocks moving around on the screen.
No, absolutely. And I think the way you even, you know, framed it right there was exactly my thesis going in. You know, that was my experience as a kid. You know, Super Breakout was a mind-bending, you know, sort of transformative experience for me. I mean, I love the Breakout games on the Atari 2600, but this picture of this astronaut in space with this rainbow wall sort of reflected on the curve of his helmet, it took it to another place for me. It added this level of story to it, and I was fascinated by that because, like you, I just, you know, those games are simple enough, but just the mere suggestion, just the sort of the sketch of story sort of imbued the whole gameplay with totally, you know, additional meaning. And those are the only really, that generation of games is the only generation where I think that is really true, and that art, you know, is not purely marketing. Here it's actually part of the storytelling. You know, so I wanted to explore that as well. I wanted to talk to the artists and say, you know, was that 100% intentional? Was it, you know, a happy accident? Like, what was the thinking behind that? And it was really fun digging these people up. I think that was actually, that also helped me as well. You know, I have a journalism background, but, you know, I'm a creative director. And so it was actually very comfortable for me to interview people who had, some of them had never been interviewed. And also some of them, you know, I literally had people say, are you serious? You really want to talk to me? You think anyone, I remember this is, I forget who told me this, but when I was interviewing people, one guy basically almost laughed me off the phone and said, do you really think someone's going to want to read about this? Like, he wasn't even being mean about it. He was literally, he was confounded. He didn't believe it. But I think that really, that helped me in this interview process because I got to explore that. I got to explore that with these creative people.
Yeah, I mean, I experienced that too when I kind of go after interviewing people who made a game, you know, they live in Japan and, you know, created something for Famicom like 25, 30 years ago. And I'm like, hey, I'd like to interview you. And they're like, really? And an American wants to talk to me about this game that hardly anyone has heard of in the States. Like, why would you want to do that? But there are people out there who are hungry to know more about this, who, you know, maybe they played the games or maybe they're just curious about video game history, but they do want to know. So it's always great to be able to get those, you know, those firsthand resources, especially, and those accounts, especially as, you know, the people who worked on those first and second generation video games are getting up there in age and, you know, they're not going to be around forever. It's a kind of a bleak reality, but it's something that we're increasingly facing as crucial video game creators and, you know, people who worked in not necessarily video games, but like musicians that I love, film stars or film auteurs that I admire, like more and more of them are we're losing them. And so it's great to be able to get those accounts before it's too late.
Yeah, no, it really, I mean, not to be morbid about it, but it does feel a little bit like the clock is ticking, you know, and I don't want those, you know, those stories not to be captured. And I think for me, it's always been interesting about the creative process and understanding how people think about what they do and how they articulate that, you know, whether that's in logo design or here, you know. And I think for me, it was, you know, I looked at, you know, all these Atari programmers who had made some of the, you know, these iconic games of my childhood and really in video game history. And it just felt like it was very well covered ground. And I wanted to talk to the people who no one really thought to talk to them about this stuff and really get their fresh ideas about it. And it was actually really fun. It was very satisfying to talk to some of these people. I mean, you know, one artist, when we initially started talking, you know, and this is over the course of several years, didn't want to talk to me at all, you know, and he was sort of embarrassed by this early work. And then by the end of it, you know, he felt like this had sort of caused a sort of a renaissance in interest in his early work, but also what he was doing then, and just a reminder of how fun that time in life was. So it was pretty cool. I, you know, happened to be in the right place, even where talking with some of these early Atari artists and some of the creative people there, bringing them together. I did some group interviews, and some of these people hadn't seen each other for decades. So I was sort of, you know, incidentally forcing these little reunions, and it was wonderful. You know, it was really fun to be part of that, just even if tangentially. It was a lot of fun to see sort of those reconnections happening just because of my interest in this and wanting to write about it.
Yeah, you know, the work that they did is really a vanished art. Sometime around the late 90s, you really stopped seeing hand-drawn art and hand-painted art in video game covers outside of indie games or like anime-based games from Japan. And it's pretty much just, you know, CG renders now. And that's fine. It's very literal. It's very like, this is, you know, like a beautified version of what you're going to see in the game. But it really lacks that sort of, I don't know, the sense of like the spirit of the thing. Like, you, video game covers used to be about like capturing the essence of a game experience and, you know, building something around it. Whereas you really don't get that anymore outside of indie games. So you're kind of curating something that is no longer a part of video games, something that already has been lost.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's about capturing that emotion, because it's not a literal depiction. It's not even like an airbrushed, idealized version of game graphics the way in some ways, you know, it's been being done digitally now. And it really was capturing that, you know. And I take umbrage a little bit, you know, when I read things on the internet, people saying, oh, that early art was a bait and switch. The graphics were never that good. And that's a sort of a retconning of that thinking, because everybody knew that those were not the game graphics. It served a different function to, you know, it was about capturing the emotion. You know, when you're introducing an audience to playing games on their televisions for maybe the first time, you want to get the emotion and the energy in playing tennis, because tennis on the Atari 2600 is not going to look the same as real life tennis. So they're creating this, you know, sort of emotional bridge to those things. And that's really what it was about.
Yeah. I feel like that sort of retroactive opinion about old video game covers is not giving audiences of 40 years ago a whole lot of credit. Like,
yeah.
I don't think anyone looked at the 2600 version of Space Invaders and said, oh, I bet this game is actually going to have these very detailed flying saucers zapping, you know, humans as they run away, like very realistic looking humans. Like, this is exactly what I'm going to see on my screen. Everyone knew what the limitations of video games were at that point. We didn't expect, you know, pick up Frogger thinking, oh, there's actually going to be a frog in like a, you know, a hat and a suit coat dashing across a highway as a realistic looking car runs him down. Like, we knew, but it was basically, you know, sort of like, here's the sort of the aspirational concept of what this game would like to be. Here's, you know, something to put into your mind as you're playing this incredibly simplistic looking abstraction of a game. Like, this, you know, kind of grounds your experience in imagery that you recognize and gives kind of some definition to what ultimately amount to, you know, some pixel blobs on the screen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think those things worked in tandem, right? And you know, that was part of this, you know, if we're going to use it in modern terms, it's like this 360 degree experience of playing those games. It was everything from the moment you walked up to that game box in the, you know, the video store on the on your corner of your street, and to getting it home, plugging it in. And all of those pieces were parts of this whole game experience, which is much more than looking at a review on YouTube and then, you know, ordering the download now and, you know, and letting it load on your console. It's a different experience with different pieces. And I think it's hard to totally describe in a way that makes sense if you did not quite live through it.
We don't like to fight. Here on Zordon we work hard and try to do what's right. We would never be the first one.
Yeah, so one of the great things about the Art of Atari book is that it does have so many high-quality reproductions of, you know, the original artwork and the pieces and packaging and so forth. I'm assuming there's no central repository for that sort of thing. So how did you go about sourcing that material?
Yeah, you know, it was funny because, you know, obviously it's a licensed book. You know, my publisher, Dynamite Entertainment, you know, had this license for Atari, and Atari, for their parts, they were great. And they're like, we don't really have anything, but we're happy to help.
Yeah, Atari has been like three or four companies since the 2600 days. So I just assume there's no like archive there.
No. So, I mean, it really, you know, it was really, I felt like Indiana Jones, right? It was very much about tracking this stuff down. And a big part of this really started, you know, there was two aspects of it when I was in the early days, this before I had a book contract, really when this thing was just still, you know, germinating as an idea. One was I just totally randomly got a chance to interview Cliff Spahn, who was one of the original Atari artists, you know, and that's a longer story I can talk about in a minute. But the other one was another collector was selling a bunch of slides and negatives of Atari artwork, and I was able to get my hands on the stuff. I was able to buy this, and it wasn't a ton, but it was like, you know, 30, 40, 50 pieces, but it was this nugget that I could start building around. And then when I reached out to artists and I said, hey, I want to interview you. I'm also looking for, you know, artwork that you still have. I could point to, you know, I have this piece, I have that piece. You know, it brought something that I actually could put in the book. You know, once you scan the stuff and, you know, at high resolution, and that's the awesome thing about photographic negatives and transparencies is they really yield super, super detailed imagery. So some of these things are 4 inches by 5 inches, but they're photographic, you know, negatives. So they're really, really, really high quality. Mm-hmm. So you could blow them up really large. But then, you know, once I was, you know, able to talk with these artists, some of whom, you know, had their portfolios, there was an occasional original piece here and there, you know, usually in the hands of collectors, but also a lot of these artists still had their portfolios, you know, in quotes, you know, in the form of little boxes of these 4x5 transparencies, because that's how you did it, right, in the 70s and 80s. And so I would reach out to one artist and they say, oh, well, you know, I have this and this that I did. And have you talked to this person? Or you had you know, and it started spiraling and it was like a snowball rolling down the hill. And I got to the point where I was like, okay, you know, I have, you know, about 50, 60% of what I wanted, you know, talking to collectors who I knew who had original art, you know, reaching out to all the artists, asking them if they knew people. And it was really sort of like just using the network to find this stuff. You know, some of it was a couple of museums had a couple of pieces. But I mean, I did everything. I, you know, we photographed original artwork. We scanned transparencies and slides. We went back to like large printed posters and we used those. We photographed game boxes. And then I remember at one point, one of the graphic designers, Evelyn Cito, who I interviewed for the book, and she was super helpful because she was one of those people at Atari. Being a graphic designer, she interfaced with the illustrators. She talked with the designers and the writers and the creative directors, so she knew everybody. And she said, hey, you know, I reached out to the photographer who shot all this flat artwork that we use. So, you know, you'd have a painting and then you'd have somebody shoot it, and that's negative would become the thing, right? And she said, oh, I think he might have some pieces. So I reached out to this guy. He's like, oh, I think I might have something in my attic. And I, you know, at this point I would have driven 50 miles, 100 miles to get one piece of art, right? And I had done that. And he's like, oh, I might have a couple. And he comes back and he's like, I have 45 of these. And I was just like the heavens opened and it was like, hallelujah, you know? And I was like, that's amazing. And it was all this stuff that I did not have, you know, accounted for in the book. And then, and he was, you know, everyone I talked to was very generous about sharing this stuff, sending it to me to scan it. And I mean, so I touched literally every single piece of artwork, both digitally and physically, that ended up in that book.
So you mentioned that this this whole project was kind of started by a quest to learn more about the Atari logo. Were you satisfied by what you dug up about that?
I'd say, you know, I would always like to know more. But, you know, learning about George Opperman, who was, you know, the art director and creative director at Atari who designed this logo, you know, he passed away in the mid-80s. So, you know, he wasn't there to talk. And so the closest thing I was able to do was talk to Evelyn, who I mentioned, who was basically, you know, did a lot of the production work and really was a right-hand person for George. She had worked with him even before he came on Atari. She actually inked the original logo. You know, so she did the production work on the original logo to make sure that it looked great. So, like, getting to talk to her, she was one of the closest people to George. I had to sort of, you know, triangulate and sort of talk to all the people who worked closely with him and get a sense of what he was like. But, you know, I'd love to see more. I mean, if you picture this, I feel like it was a Warner Brothers cartoon of me just like stumbling along and finding things and asking and reaching out to people in every way, shape, and form. I mean, I think we were getting ready to put the finishing touches on the design of the book, and someone who knew someone who knew somebody else that I had reached out to, you know, over a year earlier had said, hey, you know, I just found this thread that we were talking about. And I talked to my friend who says he has the original logo concept. So the Atari logo, is that interesting to you? And I'm just like, what? You know, so we had to make space. I mean, like literally the pages were already designed. And if you actually go to the Art of Atari, you open the book about the logo, there is a little space where we see some of the early logo concepts. And you know, they're in there because literally the pages were already designed. We had to find some place to put those. But it was just stuff like that. I felt like my approach here, I don't know that it's very systematic. I had all these things I wanted to do, but then every step of the process, even before I had a book contract, I was talking about the work that I was doing. You know, and people found out about it through the internet, through, you know, message boards like Atari Age, and then all that was sort of circulating out there. So people would find me and reach out to me, and I would continue to talk to people. And There was some kind of, you know, harmonic vibration frequency where people were just coming back to me and said, hey, is this interesting to you? Hey, I heard you were working on this. And it was this amazing, like, sort of love from the larger community of people who were interested in this book and wanted to help. And I was the beneficiary of so much of that. I mean, there's so many people, like, that if I, if they weren't sort of jumping in to be like, hey, how can I help? That, you know, a lot of this wouldn't, it could never have happened. And it's probably why there wasn't a book already. Cause I, you know, I'm not the most connected person or the most knowledgeable necessarily, but I was putting in the time and I was able to connect to so many of the right people.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the two parts you need right there is someone who is interested and willing and able to take on the task of documenting this stuff. And then, you know, also able to make those connections because you have a lot of both one or the other, but it's rare that, you know, that they both come together like that. So it's great you were able to make the book happen. You know, looking over all the work that you collected, all the artwork you compiled, do you have a single favorite piece? Is there one that really stands out and makes you say like, this is just amazing. It is like such a magnificent piece of artwork.
Yeah. You know, I have my favorites. I mean, I think when I was able to get my hands on the Missile Command artwork, mm-hmm. you know, and get hold that 4x5 transparency in my hands, I just felt like great. Like that is the iconic piece. And that's the thing that I want to lead with. And that says so much about what I want to say. It's beautifully rendered, you know, it has that sort of 70s Buck Rogers sci-fi feel. So like when I like held that in my hands and I knew it was going in the book, I just felt great about it. But I think my favorite piece, and not just from a craft perspective, you know, quality art perspective, but was just this simultaneously, it's a beautiful, ridiculous piece of art, but also the fact that I was able to unearth it was the Pac-Man, the Atari 2600 Pac-Man that Hiro Kimura did for that game. Yeah, the crazy one that wasn't ever used. And to my knowledge, other than in, you know, a brief sort of passover video in an Atari promotional video that was not widely circulated, like this was the very first time that art had ever been seen in public. And so I just felt like this is an iconic piece. It's never been seen. It's part of a, you know, larger story of Pac-Man on the 2600. So when I saw that, I literally felt like I was holding, you know, Indiana Jones and the Lost Crusade, and I'm holding the Grail. It's right there.
Now, which one is that? That's not the one where it's Pac-Man like running through the maze, grabbing wafers, and he's kind of got a buck tooth, right? It's another one.
Right. It's similar to that one where Pac-Man's all metallic. Right. And he's shiny and, you know, airbrushed, and he's running through almost like a forest, and the ghost monsters, quote unquote, you know, are chasing him, and they look very monstrous, and they've got these teeth and drool. And, you know, it was very much this like, you know, far off sort of take on Pac-Man. And clearly they kind of reined it back in for the other versions. But, you know, I just love that it just captured this weird energy. If you were like, hey, you know what, I'm just going to describe the idea of Pac-Man and paint that. That's how I felt that piece was. And I just, there's something about it that's, it's not a naivete, but it's just like this sort of unfettered fantasy version of Pac-Man.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking at that now, and it's like Pac-Man looks like a Hajime Sorayama like robot woman, kind of like super chrome, except of course, yeah, not erotic, but yeah, he's definitely got that kind of look to him, like very metallic and shiny, and the monsters are wild. It's like something from, you know, Sesame Street or the Muppet Show, like what, like one of those really big ungainly Muppets that takes like four people to act.
Yeah, totally.
That's really interesting, huh? So you mentioned that you had a story about, oh crap, I forgot his name, someone's Spawn, I think?
Yeah, Cliff Spawn.
Yeah, Cliff Spawn, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, and that was really the genesis of this project. You know, this was basically like 2011, I think. You know, I was running a design firm with a friend of mine who actually incidentally was the chief designer. He's the one who designed the Art of Atari book. We were working on a blog post. You know, we had a firm. We had an office here in Chicago, and his office was out in L.A. And I said, hey, let's write a blog post for Thanksgiving about the, you know, the artists and the designers that we're thankful for, right? And so one of those people I wrote was Cliff Spawn. You know, and there's all kinds of people. And there's Cliff Spawn. You know, Sid Mead, the conceptual designer. And mm-hmm. I wrote this blog post. There were some images. Great. You know, we're this little bitty design firm. You know, we didn't have a huge reach or anything like that. But, you know, months and months later, I got a comment on that story, and this woman writes and said, hey, this is really cool. I'm a graphic designer too, so it was neat to see this, but I grew up down the street from Cliff Spahn, and I still see him. He's a family friend. Would you like to meet him? Would you like to talk to him? And I was just like, well, of course, that sounds amazing, you know, because all these questions that I had that we'd already been talking about making the art for, you know, Atari were just there in my head. So she connected us. And, you know, Cliff has done, you know, did almost 20 pieces for the 2600, and he did a lot of other artwork for Atari. He also did, you know, some work for Apple. Interesting enough, Steve Jobs actually offered him a job, and he said, hey, come work for Apple. Don't bother with this video game stuff. You can be salaried, you know, you can have stock options, you know, come work for me. You know, he had done like some manual illustrations, and he's like, I don't know if this Apple thing's going anywhere. And he turned it down. He's like, I like the freelance life. And, you know, I think he regretted that a little bit later, but in any case, we talked, you know, I got on the phone with him. I had a yellow pad sitting there. I was like, oh, maybe he'll say something interesting. I'll learn a couple things. I hang up the phone like 2.5 hours later. We have this amazing conversation, and he remembered every piece that he did in such exquisite detail. You know, he wasn't even looking at this stuff, you know, because again, it only existed in those boxes. But he had such great recall over all these pieces, and they were so interesting in terms of creative process. And I hung up the phone and I looked at just these pages of scribble that I had, you know, written down. And I didn't plan on this being some sort of official interview, but I realized, I'm like, if anyone else has stories like this, there's a book here. You know, and that was the first time that, you know, and I just fell into it. And I feel like the more I tell you these stories, it's just me like bumbling around like, and then I have, you know, I feel like Forrest Gump, you know, it's like I'm bumbling around. Oh, I bumped into this guy and I met this person. I mean, and that's really, that was sort of the first step of this book, you know, and then I said, oh, this could be a book. And then I, you know, as it gained momentum, I'd talk to more people and they'd say, well, what are you doing? Who have you talked to? And, you know, one person would introduce me to this person. And then I'd, you know, suddenly someone else would come say, hey, I know you've talked to those people. Let's talk. And then, you know, I was working on it and I had just started down the road of looking for a publisher and had even pitched it to a couple places myself. And then I kind of heard through the grapevine that Dynamite Entertainment, you know, who became the publisher of the book, were planning on doing an art, you know, an Atari art book. And I was like, well, that's weird. But we connected and, you know, lo and behold, it was amazing for them because they connected with me and I had already had, you know, a good chunk of this book sort of plotted out. And, you know, so they were able to just, you know, they said, hey, you're doing this, go for it. You know, and they said, this is kind of what we want, but we see that you have a vision, and they let me run with it. I mean, it was unbelievable the amount of rope they gave me, you know, for good or for bad. You know, I stand by the decisions, you know, there was minimal sort of interference about, like, you know, little things here and there, what they wanted, but they were able to say, hey, you've got a vision, you know, go for it. And that was an unbelievable part of the process.
So, you know, I don't want to take too much time, but I did want to talk a little bit about some of your other work. You mentioned you put together a Street Fighter book. You know, you said with the art of Atari, you felt like the game design, the creators, the corporate side, like that's all well-trodden ground and you wanted to cover something new. Did you take the same direction, the same angle with Street Fighter? Because that's also a very well kind of established, like, the history of the game and the design of the game and the character biographies and things like that. So, you know, what approach did you take to tackling the Street Fighter franchise?
Yeah, that was a little different. I mean, like, I felt like Art of Atari was very, you know, it's kind of virgin territory. No one was really talking about the art and the, you know, the marketing side of it. So, like, I was kind of free to do whatever. With Street Fighter, you know, it was one of several books that we were looking at, you know, and I knew I, you know, it really wasn't that long after Art of Atari. I knew I didn't want to write that book, but, you know, we were looking at Street Fighter as a franchise, not just the, you know, the first game. When we were saying, like, how has this impacted games? How has it touched on, you know, media? How do, what part did the art play? You know, we were really trying to sort of thread the needle. And so I didn't write this book. Steve Hendershot, who is a friend of mine and a phenomenal journalist, I mean, a real, like, an actual working journalist, unlike myself, wrote this book. And, you know, it comes out of his childhood, arcade childhood, of Street Fighter 2, and we really looked at what are the stories out there, you know, in the Street Fighter fan community, in the sort of nascent esports community of the 90s, like what were those moments? And he really dug into, like, sort of digging into those. And we knew we wanted to talk to the artists, and we wanted to talk about how moving a game from one part of the world to another, how the art had to be different, you know, and talked about some of the biases in there and sort of the, you know, especially in the 80s and 90s, the Western ideas of what was going to sell and how games should be packaged and what the characters should sort of look like. And we wanted to talk about that sort of East-West kind of thing that really, you know, only sort of, I feel like, exists now. Now we're, you know, it's a much more visually global culture. Mm-hmm. And so those were all the ideas that we had. But it was very much like, okay, what has been done? And we wanted to sort of find our own path there.
Hmm. All right. So can you talk about what you're working on now, like current projects you have and kind of where you see yourself going from there?
Yeah, right now, you know, I continue to do package design, logo design, and all that. That's still like my bread and butter, but I've done more and more at this place, sort of in video games, pop culture, and art. So I sort of took on this project myself this year, you know, being the 40th, you know, I'm, you know, just a tick older than Pac-Man, but it's, you know, Pac-Man's a game and even like a pop culture property that I grew up with. And I just think it's an interesting thing. This sort of started in my head a couple years back. I went to my daughter's school, you know, when she was in like first grade or maybe it was kindergarten. And, you know, it's like career day and you come in, you talk about what you do, right? You know, and I said, well, I make books about video games. And these little kids are all sitting on the floor. And I said, how many people know who Pac-Man is? And all of these like 5 and 6 year olds raised their hand. And it kind of blew me away. Like, I mean, they all knew who Pac-Man was, which just absolutely confounded me. And I was just like, wow, this really seems like Pac-Man continues to, you know, persist, you know, continues to be somewhat relevant in pop culture. You know, I love the original Pac-Man. You know, I've played many of those games on many different platforms, you know, and you see, you know, there are even more modern versions of the cartoons and, you know, the new games. And it just got me thinking, what is it about Pac-Man that, you know, why does Pac-Man persist after 40 years and not just sort of hanging on as this cultural icon? There really is, there's something there. And I wanted to figure that out. And so I said, well, is that a book? Is that, you know, a series of articles? You know, is it an examination of the visuals? You know, and I've sort of attempted all those things. But what I decided, I wanted to do something that would sort of encapsulate all those things. So this year, starting in January 1st, I basically am trying to experience Pac-Man every day for the entire year. So I have this thing called 365 of Pac that I'm doing on social media, on Instagram and Twitter, and a little bit on Facebook. And I'm basically trying to play my way through every version of Pac-Man on every platform and looking at all of these sort of pop culture instances. So, you know, looking at the lunch boxes and the artwork and, you know, the jackets and the erasers and the, you know, the raviolis and all of these weird things that come, you know, the board games and the video games about board games and the board games that are supposed to be like the video games, and playing all these different versions on all these platforms and trying to understand, what is it about the sort of soul of the Pac-Man as a pop culture, you know, character, but also as a game, that why does it persist? And so it's sort of this exercise in sort of crazy binging Pac-Man as I'm documenting every single day. My eventual goal is to write a book about that, you know, and I don't know if it'll be like my life of 1 year with Pac-Man or something along those lines. You know, I sort of envision it as a little bit of a memoir slash video game history, but it's more like experience history. You know, I'm not necessarily just trying to tell the history of Pac-Man, although I think that's part of it. I'm really trying to have an experience, sort of an experience, and I want to write about that.
All right. So that sounds actually very ambitious and interesting. So I'm going to wrap here, but if people wanted to read about your 365 Days of Pac-Man project or, you know, pick up a copy of Art of Atari, where can they find you and your work online?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter and Instagram as Tim Lapatino and Lapatino, and I'm also doing the 365 of Pac-Man at 365 of Pac. So I also, you know, on my website, timlapatino.com, I'm kind of, you know, it's sort of the clearinghouse for all the work that I do. So, yeah, I'm just trying to make my way through this bridge of where pop culture and video games and art and design sort of all intersect. And that's the place where I just kind of parked myself for now.
All right. Awesome. And again, if you listening to this have not seen the book Art of Atari, definitely pick it up. It is an essential coffee book table. Just some amazing reproductions and firsthand accounts in there. Really great stuff. So, Tim, thanks very much for your time and good luck with your Pac-Man endeavors. It sounds still got a ways to go. Still got like 9 months of that to go.
Totally. Well, thanks. Yeah, I'm trying to pace myself. But no, it's been really fun. Thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely.